This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal, and there is just so much to unpack. One day before the deadline to register to run for Toronto City Council or Toronto's mayor. And things are happening fast and furious. As you heard in Chris's news less than an hour ago, MPP Kristen Wong Tam held a news conference endorsing a very unknown candidate who is going to run against another entrenched, very left-wing candidate, Chris Moyes. So it looks like people on the same side of that very ideological spectrum are maybe getting tired of his antics, like getting taxpayers to foot an unauthorized and unnecessary legal bill, renaming a parquet without any consultation after successfully spearheading the renaming of Yonge Dundas Square, and emblazoning his own name on some public works in the ward. So maybe they're getting tired of it. And the question I asked, with two candidates on the left running against each other, does that mean that Daniel Tate of Integrity Toronto, who is also running there, does that give him an opportunity to come up through the middle? And then there was almost explosive news yesterday that veteran councillor Paula Fletcher won't run again. And she made this announcement 2 days after registering to run again. Now, she characterized it as an epiphany on the lake. Former Mayor John Tory said, you know, that sounds almost as good as I want to spend more time with my family. So I will talk to our panel about what they think is behind that one. And then there are a raft of other announcements, mostly on the left side. For council, we have Mike Layton jumping in also to run against another left-wing candidate. And we have Nate Erskine-Smith. Boy, he's saying he just wants to serve the people of the beaches. You know, this after basically failing at two other levels of government. You know, I just don't understand how some of these people say things with a straight face. But what do you think, people? The numbers, 866-744-740. That is our text line, our long distance phone line, and 416-360-0740.
And now it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome Toronto City Councillors John Burnside, Ward 16, Don Valley East, James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre, and former Toronto City Councillor Karen Stintz. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Libby.
Hi. Where to start? John, is there anything here that surprised you, or what surprised you the most? You're muted. Okay, are you there, John?
My apologies. There were a lot of surprises. I think on the Mike Layton side, you know, 2 weeks ago he said he was not going to get into politics because of his family, and now he's getting into politics because of his family. So I like Mike, but I mean, the things that people, politicians, the things we say are quite unbelievable. The Erskine-Smith, that was not surprising. But the Sean Chen, the MP, federal MP, who literally got out of the race, or got out, actually resigned from federal parliament because of his health. I don't know, Karen, was that a few days ago? Yeah. Is now running to be a councillor. I guess his health is miraculously, he's had a miraculous recovery.
Okay. do you have anything to say before we move on about Kristen Wong Tam endorsing someone to run against Chris Moyes?
Well, that's definitely a lover's quarrel because she did endorse him, Chris Moyes, that is, in the last election. But Chris has treated the ward he represents as a fiefdom like I've never seen before. And so I think there's been a lot of tension there. I think the most amusement I got was the news conference itself. It was about 20 minutes of self-congratulations by Kristen Wong Tam. And I actually like her, but I literally thought she was going to announce that she was running for mayor with all the accolades she piled upon herself.
Okay, let us move along. James, what is the biggest news here for you, and what, if anything, surprised you?
Well, this mayor has always said we need more women in politics, and then we have Mike Layton and Nate Erskine-Smith, both men, trying to defeat women. I mean, Mike Layton is running against incumbent Diane Sachs, and Nathan Erskine-Smith is trying to bring down frontrunner Natalie Johnson. So I found that kind of amusing. With Mike Layton, he did leave politics because his family was quite young. They're still pretty young. And if he thinks things have gotten quieter at City Hall, he is absolutely wrong. I'd like to touch on the Sean Chen again. To come to City Hall as a slower pace from federal politics, you clearly don't understand what we're up against at the local level. It is a total grind, an all-consuming job. There's only 25 councillors for 3 million people. He will find that it is no break at City Hall from the workload from an MP. So Paula Fletcher's departure, surprising but not surprising. She was getting towards the end of a long career. Surprised at the way she did it after registering, and then she had second thoughts and pulled out, and that is her prerogative.
Karen.
Wow, right? It's been a week. I don't know why, given that Paula Fletcher is resigning, or not running again, rather, that I don't understand why Mike Layton or Nathan Erskine-Smith wouldn't run in that riding, that ward. But again, I got to say, I don't understand this need to get back into politics once you've left. Like, I tried it. I did. I left City Hall and then I ran federally and I lost. I can tell you, I have zero desire to get back in the ring. So I really wonder what motivates these individuals who have, like, particularly Nate Erskine-Smith. Like, what's going on in your head that you think that you can get elected after all of the setbacks that you've just had in the same area with the same people that you want to go back and get the same votes from? Like, I don't, that I would love to understand.
He needs a job. That would be my guess.
But he's becoming more unemployable with every time he runs and he loses. Like, that's not a path to. And with all this, you know, I thought maybe with Paula not running, then maybe Chris Alexander, if he really wants to serve the city, this could maybe be his route in, because he's not going to be mayor. And so if he's so passionate about the city, then maybe here's an opportunity for him to step forward. But the rest of it, quite frankly, is bananas. Like, I don't know what's going on with Sean Chen. Like, at your point, like, maybe he didn't like the commute to Ottawa. I don't even understand. But the whole thing is just, it's just bananas.
Okay. I'm going to give the numbers out again. People, I know this is a lot to take in, but people really have a lot to say about municipal politics, even if they don't live in Toronto. So give us a shout. We really want to hear your take. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740, and that is our text line as well. Now, on the Sean Chen thing, and I have to admit, I had no idea who he was. I did read a post from him, and he talked about this accident that he had where he woke up hanging backwards, and it's the actual just going back and forth to Ottawa, he said, that he can't handle emotionally. So I don't know. I don't know about that. That's for the people of Scarborough to decide, that there are people who say they don't believe him. But Paula Fletcher, I know a lot of people, even if they're in their 70s, if they're doing a job that they like and something they're good at and they have the good health to do it, you don't decide from one day to the next about retiring. It's something you think about long and hard, because when you step back, the phones are going to stop ringing. And, you know, this idea, a lot of people think, well, I'll work sometimes. I'll work when I want to work. You know, that's a kind of a pipe dream a lot. So who has a thought about what is behind Paula Fletcher registering one day and changing her mind the next? John.
Well, I think Paula made her mind up not to run again. I think she's about 75 and her husband is retired. And I mean, she's been a fighter for, you know, how, you know, a couple decades. The idea that she had an epiphany yesterday morning is a little bit far-fetched for me. And I actually get along with Paula. We don't see the world the same way, but I have a very good relationship with her. But the NDP are nothing if not very strategic. And I believe that they did it. She made the announcement yesterday, giving would-be candidates only 2 days to organize for that very reason, so that they hold the seat. And if she did it the last possible moment, then she could be accused of election, you know, rigging an election or trying to engineer an election. So I think this was decided months ago. And I will say one thing, another thing about them, though, they have really stolen the momentum in the last week. And I think they've really, as we go in, as we're starting to really ramp up into the election, all we're talking about are the NDP candidates. We're not talking about ideas. We're not talking about policy. And I think for Brad, he's got to really change that momentum back.
Yeah, Karen. I mean, you mentioned this. I mean, you would have thought that if this was something that was decided months ago or strategic, that they would have let other candidates, left wing, their own candidates, know that this was going to come up. So what I find strange is, okay, so Mike Layton now is running against another left wing candidate in University Rosedale. If he had waited like a day, he could have run in Danforth. I mean, I don't know. He was in Fort York, too, so he's kind of right around there. And the same for others. So, I mean, that's the question I have. If this was all strategic and part of a plan, I think some of those left-wingers would have known about it, no?
It is curious that there's left-wingers running against left-wingers and that in two wards in particular. But I am not surprised about Chris Moyes being challenged, because he has done a number of things that have set off the community. And I remember during the writing of my book, I talked to Kyle Ray, and he was frustrated with Chris Moyes. And so my guess is that they looked at it and they see Daniel Tate is leading in that area. And so then they got nervous and they wanted to put another lefty in there to sort of stem his momentum. I'm all speculation, of course, I haven't seen any polling, but for a lefty to run against a lefty, there's something going on there for sure. And, you know, for Mike Layton to come in and run against Diane Sachs, that's curiosity too, because I thought she was a staunch supporter of Olivia Chow. So there are things here that aren't really making sense if it was a coordinated, strategic NDP advancement, you know, into the takeover of the city. It's strange.
Okay. I mean, and I'm going to get to the phones in a moment, but, you know, I'm thinking one of the big critiques, especially in the mayor's race last time, was that if you have more than one kind of non-left candidate, I'm not even going to call them right of center, they aren't, that you're breaking up the vote. So now the NDP, which is supposed to be so smart and strategic, seems to be doing the same thing. And I wonder, is that an opportunity? People want change. And I'm wondering if that is an opportunity to make that happen. So people, what do you think? What do you think about another left-wing candidate in the ward that belongs to the guy who changed the name of young Dundas Square saying it wouldn't cost anything, but it's actually millions of dollars. But let us go to Valerie in Toronto. Hi, Valerie.
Hello. As before, I'm calling to speak for Nathaniel Erskine-Smith. What Karen, I think, was saying is totally misrepresented the situation. The people in Beaches East York love him. He's been elected three times, and he will be elected as a councillor. He was, in the Scarborough Southwest situation, he was, that was a mess. The Ontario Liberal Party needs to get their act together.
Okay, I would certainly agree with that, Valerie. We have heard you before. You are a Erskine-Smith supporter. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Clayton in Richmond Hill. Hi, Clayton.
Hello. I would like to say this. In the book written by Douglas Adams where they abolished all lawyers, what would happen to the city of Toronto if you abolished all parties and had a group of managers simply managing the budget, whether it was for the GTA area or Scarborough or Mississauga? If you get, let's just say, $10 billion, how can that manage the city as opposed to having all of this rhetoric between all of these councillors? It's just a thought.
Okay, Clayton, thanks for that. Well, you know, one of the critiques of the way City Hall functions or not is that it's run by staff, and some of their ideas are what Karen Stintz would call bananas, too. I think Valerie, who called, she may have been one of Nate Erskine-Smith's teachers, but, you know, I don't know if most people feel that way. He was in federal politics. He's, if nothing, if not a sore loser.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
Go ahead, James.
Yeah, I would simply say that I wanted to find out a little more about Nate Erskine-Smith, and all I found were postings of anti-Israel conspiracy theories. So this is something we do not want at City Hall, a guy who has a verisimilar hate for Israel. And that conflict
is 10,000
kilometers. He's not the only one, but he's running. And we do not need that at City Hall. We want to focus on city building and local issues and community safety. We do not want world conflict zones debated on the floor of council, even if they're tragic in nature. So this is a guy who really is focused on a conflict 10,000 kilometers away and not on the safety of the streets of Toronto. I just wanted to add that, as that caller gushed about him.
Okay. Well, yeah, and there are others who are in the same mode. Karen, you had your hand up.
No. I just agree. I agree with James. Like, I don't understand what is motivating him to run municipally and having no interest in municipal politics. But you know, what is it? Like, you've tried everything else, and now you're going to give this kick at the can? Like. So I just find it disingenuous. And I think that, you know, to my colleagues or to the councillors that are on this panel, they do good work. They're dedicated. They're in, like, they've run for election. They've won their seats. They represent their community. And I think when these people parachute in or think that they can just, you know, leave another level of government and come to City Hall and then be anointed, I actually find that disrespectful to the very people that actually work really, really hard for the city.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, John.
Yes, I just want to say a couple of things. I mean, I think the word is Erskine-Smith and Layton are both looking to 2030 for a run for mayor. So I think that's their motivation. And you can like Mr. Erskine-Smith or not. But the reality is he is going to win. He's basically a 12-year incumbent that is very popular. He will, and Layton as well. He is going to win. There, you know, the power of incumbency, we all know at the local level, is just so great that it's very difficult. And my theory as to why the other point about Layton and going after Sachs, Diane Sachs, even though she and Chris Moyes, for that matter, even though they vote with the mayor, probably in the range of 94 to 96% of the time, they are considered a thorn in the side of the mayor's office. So when they have someone like Mike Layton, it's just a switch. The vote stays the same, but they have someone a lot easier to work with than Diane Sachs. So I think that's the motivation why it looks like they're eating their own. They know that someone right of center is not going to win in Toronto, or was it Rosedale, right, in that ward, and Toronto center as well. I think it's a little bit far-fetched for anyone right of center to win. So they're happy to clean house and get rid of some of the people that, while they vote the way they like, they don't like working with them.
Well, Karen, you were just saying, I haven't looked at the recent polling, but Daniel Tate, he's doing well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I think it's more pragmatic. Like, they're not going to risk losing a representative vote unless they're really sure of the outcome. I think Mike Layton probably will beat Diane Sachs. I don't know if it's a given. But I do think that Daniel Tate has struck a nerve in the ward against Chris Moyes. And I think that is actually at play. And so, we'll see what happens. But I don't understand, like, this no-name candidate that Kristen Wong Tam endorsed. I mean, I guess she's, to your point, she feels pretty confident her endorsement is going to lead to a victory with this person. But I don't think that's necessarily the case either.
I don't at all. Like, all of these comings and goings. James, I mean, again, there's Toronto Centre, and, Layton against Sachs. What do you make of that?
Well, the big fear here is there were a number of grassroots groups trying to make sure that if Olivia Chow was reelected mayor, she would not have a majority of councillors to support her. That is now falling apart as more people jump into the race. And that is a concern, because you don't have political parties at City Hall, but you have ideologies. I don't know why Kristen Wong Tam thought, by having a press conference and making it seem like she's the prime minister or something, or the premier, and she could sway tens of thousands of votes. I don't really know what that was all about. Her endorsement probably doesn't carry a lot of weight there. Whether she can supply money and grassroots organizing, that is really the key in a municipal election. I think with nominations closing tomorrow afternoon, this is going to be a 60-day battleground, an ideological battleground, and the future of Toronto. And Torontonians have to decide what kind of future they want. Do they want more of the same of what's been going on in the last 3 years, or they want to restore it to a city of high purpose, clean parks, safety, and going about your daily lives in peace and security?
Okay. Now, just to wrap things up, so Brad Bradford has his three C's, which are crime, congestion, and cost, and people don't feel safe. There's no question the city is in decline. It's dirty. You can't get to where you're going. How do those things take primacy? How do they get back in the front burner as opposed to this other stuff? Karen, do you have thoughts?
I think after Labor Day, again, we've talked about this as well, when the momentum will kick in. And I think Brad has benefited actually from owning the headlines over the last several weeks. He's come out with strong announcements. He's made strong positions. He's, out there every day working. And so the fact that he conceded the headlines this week because there's some crazy things going on at the ward level, I don't think that's a concern. I think he will again regain and reestablish his position and reclaim his momentum. And so I think it will be a very interesting race. And I think that also at the ward level, certainly I felt it when, after David Miller resigned, and it was, an open contest between Doug Ford and George Smitherman, people were asking me who I was supporting, and that was going to determine whether they voted for me or not. And so I think particularly in some of these open wards, the alliances are going to have to be made public so people understand who they're voting for at the ward level in support of the mayor.
John, your thoughts?
Well, I think everyone talks about congestion and cost, and no one actually has a solution. So I think those two are a waste of time. I think crime should and will be the major issue, and Brad needs to own that. So that's, as I say, I think you focus on one thing that people actually think can be changed. Everyone talks about congestion. Everyone talks about costs, and nothing changes. My message to everyone listening is, if you are center or right of center, please get out of your chair and help out. The left is extremely organized. They knock on doors. They work day and night for their candidates. Those on the right tend to complain a lot. They might donate a lot, but they don't provide the people power that candidates need. And that would be my plea, because, you know, a mayor is usually around for 8 years. A councillor can be around, as we know, for 20 or 30. We need to change council seats.
Okay, well, I certainly agree with that. I forgot to mention, and I'm running into a little overtime here, I came home the other day to find a flyer, well, it's actually a little square, from Olivia Chow's People, and the things on it, I mean, we've talked about how quoting statistics, just gets people annoyed. So in big letters, Olivia Chow, crime is down. Right. And the other thing that she claimed there that I could not believe has brought down the cost of food. Oh, really? So I don't know if making claims that are just beyond the pale, I don't know how that's going to help them. I mean, but, you know, I hope it won't. I've got to wrap things up. We're going to be talking to Tasha Carradine in the next segment. In the meantime, thanks so much for all of this. Whoa. Coming and going. Thank you so much, John Burnside, Karen Stinson, James Pasternak. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Bye, take care. Bye, Libby.
Okay. We're taking a break. When we come back, Tasha is in the house, and she is going to talk to us about why she wants to become a school board trustee.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, now I'd like to welcome one of our own, Tasha Carradine, who is an occasional guest host of this show. She is also an influential commentator, writer, and lawyer at the National Post and elsewhere. And she's a very smart and talented woman.
Aww.
And she is running to be a school board trustee, a job that is not well paid and generally not glamorous in any way. And this after we've had reports all week that fewer people are running to be school trustees because the province has taken over a bunch of school boards. So, Tasha, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. And it is, I read that report too. It is a shame because it is incredibly important. I'm a school council chair at my daughter's school at Rosedale Heights School of the Arts. And my motivation comes from that experience. It comes from seeing the challenges the board faces on all levels when it comes to the safety of kids in class, the lack of excellence in education, the financial mismanagement, which got the province involved in the first place, irresponsible spending, and also the accountability factor. We need accountable leadership. So I want to bring all those things back to the TDSB, because otherwise the province is not going to lift supervision. It's going to keep running it. And because if it's not satisfied, it has good trustees in place, it will just keep going. And that doesn't help parents, Libby, because I've been at the doors and parents feel they don't have a voice at the board anymore because there are no trustees. So we need to change that.
Okay, let's get to that. I mean, again, one of the things that we really have an issue with on City Council that I think is also true of the boards, and that is the ascendancy of these very left-wing, so-called progressive ideologies, which seem to trump the need to educate the kids. How did that happen, and how do you fight it?
Well, I think that over the years, the emphasis has shifted away from academics, from instruction, from, teaching methods and focusing on how do we make kids learn better to the kinds of things you're talking about, to ideas that are more quote-unquote progressive, but that aren't helping students achieve. They're not increasing performance. Our EQAO standards right now, 51% of grade 6 kids can do math to the standard we expect. Half of them can't. This is terrible. This is where we need to put our energies, not to these kinds of other issues, changing the admissions system for specialty schools to be more equitable, this kind, creating whole bureaucracies that don't serve the ultimate goal, which is equipping kids for the future so they learn, so that they develop all these skills that they need when they leave the schools.
Okay, so my understanding is that these ideologies took hold. So first of all, the teacher training that we have is permeated with them. And the people who actually teach the kids and run the schools on the ground, the so-called educators. So how do you get rid of that as a trustee? You're not there day to day.
Yeah, that the training of teachers is not what trustees do. What trustees are there to do is to basically make sure that what the staff does in terms of its programming, its reports, reflect the real needs and priorities of the community. And that is what's missing, because as you point out, that some teachers do these sorts of things are in line with these kinds of these priorities. But others, I know a lot of teachers who feel very frustrated because they want to focus on teaching. They want their PA days to be about, how do I get through to that kid who may have a learning disability, or how do I get through to that kid who's not motivated? They don't want to sit there and have the same ideological stuff time after time, right, put in front of them. It doesn't serve the purpose of teaching. And so I think that trustees, our role is to say, if the staff comes up with programs that don't make sense, push back and say, no, that is not reflecting the priorities. We don't accept that report, and we don't accept this, this direction. And the direction starts at the top. And the trustees are important because that's where parents also can go if they have an issue. If their principal is not in line, if it doesn't, let's say their kid has an issue at school, let's say there's an anti-Semitism, which is rampant, and you butt up against a principal who maybe doesn't share your view. 49% of parents actually said they didn't feel their complaints were taken seriously on anti-Semitism. Where else do you go? Your trustee. Right now, there are no trustees. So we have to have responsible people in there who will listen to parents, take these issues seriously, and will be able to help them navigate the system.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about the rampant anti-Semitism in schools, often perpetrated by the teachers. And even when it gets, in some cases, to the level of assault, and even if they know which kids are guilty of that, they give the kid a pass because they say that kid is from a racialized minority. So, go ahead and assault Jewish kids.
Yeah, the numbers are really shocking. The last data that we have show that incidents of anti-Semitism grew by 50% between 2022 to 2023 and the 2023-24 school year. So over that period of time, you went from about 200 incidents to over 300 incidents. That's one in every 30 Jewish children being subject to either a slur, a Nazi salute, swastikas drawn on things in the classroom, to the kinds of assault stuff you're talking about. That's the most serious piece. But the issue is that this has not been addressed by the TDSB. They have lumped in anti-Semitism to their general anti-racism policy that came in 2025. The real issue is education, and it starts with countering the disinformation kids see on TikTok, on social media, about these issues that is historically inaccurate, that's feeding them the wrong stuff, that's telling them it's demonizing Israel, it's demonizing Jews. That's where the education in the schools has to counter it. And it does, you're right, teachers have to be on board with that too. It has to be in the curriculum, and it has to be very serious. And there is some Holocaust education, but it's not sufficient. It has to be broader because this is a whole of society issue. It's not just about Jewish kids. It's about all of us and the values we share in Canada, equality, freedoms, fundamental freedoms. Those things have to be emphasized in the curriculum.
Okay, well, again, these are huge issues to take on. And you look like you're primed to do it. But again, the question is, do you think you'll be able to do it from that perch?
Well, it's better a perch than no perch, right? And right now, I've been active in the system for 4 years, very active, actually. And before that, too, on other issues, you know, of the disability community and autism spectrum children. I've fought for that for years as well. But this is now, to me, a very particular time. The province, like I said, has taken over the board. So no trustees are sitting yet. They could sit there for they could do this for 3 years, right? They could run out the clock. That is no good. So I believe trustees who are elected will have a position to speak from. You're elected to a position. You can speak. I can speak to you. I can speak to the media until we sit. And I think the province also is looking for, like I said, responsible partners at the trustee level that they can deal with and they feel will be working in the best interests of kids, which is my agenda. I want to work in the best interests of the children, my daughter's friends, her school, all the schools, the 50 schools. 50 schools will be in my ward. The province has made some serious mistakes, I believe, in limiting the number to 12, and some of the cuts they have made have been wrong. But at the same time, the TDSB also has to clean house on its spending and its education policies. So I think, you know, both sides have to take responsibility, and I can only try, but I will try.
Okay. sounds like a formidable task. And one of the other things is that traditionally, and the left has used this, I think, very strategically, school board trustee, it's kind of like an entry-level political job. And even today we've seen, and I think even in just the announcement about Ward 13, a school board trustee who's going to run for councillor. And it just seems to be that, again, it's like an entry-level job.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. I don't see it that way. It certainly is not for me. I have no other ambitions other than to fix the school system, because I think that it is so important as a mother, as someone who's been watching this as an advocate as well. I feel that it is, you know, we tend to not even vote for trustee, which, like, to your listeners, vote for your trustee, whoever your trustee candidates are in your ward. It is important.
And first find out who they are.
Find out who they are, but pick one and vote for them, because it is extremely important. We leave this as, like you said, it's seen as, oh, yeah, it's and people have used this to go to other things. It shouldn't be that. I think that, you know, if we take it seriously, we can make something very important of it and see if some real reform and get the kids back, because the TDSB is losing 5,000 students this year. That shouldn't be happening. It's partly because parents have lost faith in the system, and we need to get that faith back.
Okay. Turning now, again, developments in your ward. We just heard Kristen Wong-Tam, NDP, MPP, endorse somebody completely unknown to run against another so-called progressive candidate, Chris Moyes, who we've talked about, so many times, you know, really conducting his area like a fiefdom, as John Burnside just said.
I heard.
taxpayers covering spurious legal bills, renaming of parquets that are beloved, like all of that. So what do you make of that? And do you think that Daniel Tate, the Integrity Toronto candidate now, who has uncovered a lot of this stuff, do you think he can come up through the middle?
There are a lot of people running in this ward. So honestly, Libby, anything is possible right now. I heard the endorsement that Kristen Wong-Tam gave. Full disclosure, I consider her a friend. I think we're on different political sides of the spectrum, but she's extremely hardworking as a politician and very sincere. And I think that if she's fed up with what she's seen, that speaks volumes. I think, though, that, you know, the voters of Toronto Center have a lot of choice. Daniel Tate's campaigning hard. Moises, he came to my door. You know, he's fighting for that seat. Curran is, like, all of them are. So right now, actually, it serves the voters very well, because we will have a choice. We will be able to see. People are going to fight for those votes. And I just hope that whoever gets in deals with the real issues of poverty, homelessness, addiction. I see them on Parliament Street all the time. I live in Cabbage Town. It is really sad, and that has to be cleaned up. And you're right, right now, it's not been.
It's not been, no. All these other ideological priorities. And again, I didn't even remember, thanks for pointing it out, that Chris Moyes only got 10,000 votes last time.
That's true.
So We'll see what happens.
It will be quite the contest. I mean, it's quite the contest in Toronto Centre. It's quite the contest in TDSB Ward 7, where I'm running. So people live in Toronto Centre, University of Rosedale, or St. Paul's. They are in my ward. So I would love to have their vote. If you're listening, great. At the very least, I ask you to vote for somebody because it is important to do so. Take it seriously.
How many people are running against you?
There are about six, I think, at this point.
Wow.
We'll see if someone jumps in tomorrow. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Big race.
Okay. Well, all the best to you, Tasha. And we will, of course, be talking to you again soon, I hope. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Libby.
Okay. People, we are taking another break. And when we come back, I just consider this, celebrity gossip. I can't resist, though. Harry and Meghan are moving back to the UK. What is behind that? When we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, now to the big international gossip piece. Harry and Meghan are moving back to the UK. Now, I consider them celebrities, and stories about them celebrity gossip, which I usually stay away from, but I can't resist. So why are they moving back after all the dirty laundry aired in public that caused a huge rift between them and the rest of the royals? We haven't heard much about them lately in the United States, even though they were the darling it couple when they moved to this side of the pond 6 years ago. Now, in Britain, they still are and have always been big tabloid fodder. And Prince Harry has crusaded against what he calls illegal invasions of their privacy. He's been doing that through the courts. He just lost a lawsuit last month against the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, all of which begs the question to me, why are they moving back? People, what do you think? 866-740-4740 or 416-360-0740. And now I am joined by Justin Volk, who is a member of the advisory board of the Institute for the Study of the Crown in Canada, an adjunct professor of history at Redeemer University, and Antonia Wyatt, who is a deputy editor of Zoomer.com. Thank you both so much for joining us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's begin with Justin. So why do you think they're moving back, and what does it mean?
Well, the first thing that comes into my mind is it means they're gluttons for punishment, because they are not terribly popular in the United Kingdom. Their popularity has really never been lower. So that tells me that there's something afoot. They've got some kind of big plan in mind. We don't know what that is yet, but there's no way that they would return to the United Kingdom being so unpopular without it being part of a larger plan, whether that's for their brand, whether that's for the family, trying to rebuild some of those bridges that they burned. It's hard to say at the moment, but they've definitely got something brewing, I would say.
So do you have a number for, has there been polling on their popularity?
I haven't seen anything recently, but from what I was seeing, at least last year, they were polling in October the same level as Andrew Mountbatten.
Oh, dear. Let's move to Antonia. What's your take, Antonia? Why do you think they're going back?
Well, I am actually English originally, and the English have a bit of a thing about the British education. And I do think that at this point in time with their children at school age, it is a moment where you make a decision. And I think the decision is to enroll them in the British school system. And I think also be closer to their family and to their roots that way. And I kind of understand the move at this point in time.
And does it make sense to you that they would take a hit with their popularity? And, you know, the tabloids are still interested in them. I'm not sure that they hate that all that much. But does it make sense to you that they would basically, you know, take a hit so that their children could be educated there?
Well, I think in a way, the tabloids have never stopped with them anyway. So why not strike out for what they believe their family needs? And also with King Charles not well, I would think that Harry would be weighing up the importance of family versus what is going on with the tabloids, which will never go away. And he's in a very different position now than he was 6 years ago when he moved to the US. He has kind of a larger family to think about and their futures to think about. And so he might be just wanting to place them within the bosom of the family and where he's from, and also have a chance at a relationship with their grandfather. I think it would be very hard to be a royal and not really know, a British royal, and not really know your country or where you're from when you have so much interest swirling around you. So I think to get to know that for them is important.
Okay. What do you think of that explanation, Justin?
Well, I certainly agree with everything Antonio was saying, particularly about the British school system. I went to school for a time in the UK, so I certainly know how advantageous it is, the networking that will allow for their children is tremendous. It will put them in a position for the best possible educational trajectories in the future. And I also agree that it seems like ever since the king was diagnosed with cancer, certainly the hostile rhetoric from Harry really got dialed back. So it wouldn't surprise me if part of this is simply Harry has sort of taken stock and, as Antonio was saying, sort of realizing what's important at this stage in his life. But I have learned with the Sussexes that there's always what they show the media, and then usually they show something to the media with the right hand, and then they try to slip something in with the left hand when nobody's looking. So I'm not trying to be cynical, but experience has taught me to keep an eye on what else might be coming from them in the near future.
Okay, I'm going to read a text and take a call. This is Dawn in Hamilton, and she writes that Harry and Meghan found out it's hard to make a living, back to living off the royals and British taxpayers. Okay, from what I've read, they are not moving to a royal residence, and they're still not working royals. So, you know, we'll run that by our experts. And I'll take a call from Jody in Toronto. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Libby. My sense is that they're just broke. They can't afford to live the way they've been living. I'm sure they've gone through the money that Diana left him. They have no source of income. They just can't afford to live on their own. Now they say that they're not going to be working royals, but the royals will be subsiding them somehow or other. I think they're just broke, Libby.
Well, you know, and I run this by our experts. I have read that they're worth about $60 million U.S., and Harry made $20 million from the tell-all book. So I don't know, you know, I don't know about that. But let's ask Antonia, do you think that this is that money is part of this?
I don't think so. But I really, you know, of course, don't have any intel on that, insider intel. But I do know that they certainly generate a lot of money for the British tabloids and social media, etc. I mean, to the tune of about £70 million is what I heard on the Telegraph this morning. So they do actually, the irony is that their move back to the UK is actually just going to add more profit for the very tabloids that Harry was fighting against, and for that kind of intrusion into their lives, they are going to help fund that. I'm sure that there were champagne corks popping on Fleet Street last night as people found out about this move.
So. Justin, those numbers that I quoted, I read them. Do they jive with what you know?
They do. Harry has raked in tens of millions from his Netflix series, Meghan, from her shows, the book deals. And actually, if anything, the move back to the UK would actually create greater financial strain for them, because cost of living is substantially higher. They will not be getting subsidized by the royals in any way. Parliament is not adding them back into the sovereign grant, and they are not getting the royal security detail. So they are going to be paying higher utility costs, higher rent, landowning costs, higher security costs. So it seems like conserving money wouldn't be the primary goal if they're going to be moving back to the UK of all places.
That was one of Harry's big things and complaints, that the public didn't pay for his security detail. I mean, all kinds of celebrities pay for their own security. And if you're worth $60 million, why would the public pay? But Antonia, was there a bad reaction to those requests in Britain? I think there was.
Reaction, and as we know, the new Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, came on today saying that absolutely not will their security be paid for, that they're private citizens. So yes, I think, but I also think a lot of people felt the security, I don't know, that Prince Harry was slightly hiding behind the security issue to disguise greater issues that were going on. But I think that has been a point of great discussion and question marks now. Like, well, why would it be any better now if that's been his great complaint? Yes.
Well, exactly. We're basically out of time. I'm going to give the last 20 seconds to Justin. What conclusion do you draw? I don't think there's nothing official that this will do, right?
No, not in terms of the royals and as they operate in the working royals. I think Antonia really hit the nails on the head. If people are watching this expecting that this is going to lead to Harry and Meghan being next to Will and Kate in a year's time, in terms of royal duties, that's not happening. And so I think people are going to be really surprised by the amount of privacy that Harry and Meghan are going to be insisting upon and raising their children in that privacy.
Okay. We're actually a little over time. Thank you so much, Justin Volk and Antonia Wyatt. Bye-bye.
Thank you
very much. Take care.
Okay, that's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. People, Free For All Friday is coming up tomorrow. And don't forget, tomorrow is the new deadline for the trade deal. Big news. And we haven't heard from Doug Ford yet about whether he is putting alcohol back on the shelves, which is an ask from the Prime Minister. We don't really know what's in that deal. And there's all this stuff unfolding at City Hall, lots to talk about. So please give us a shout tomorrow, 866-744-740. Long distance phone, texts 416-360-0740. I'll be back here tomorrow.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.